Yes, he nods politely and says, "Nice to meet you, Daphne." "You too," I say. "She's staying with us for a couple of days," Ashley tells him. "Cool." He pulls a handheld video game out of his backpack. She asks about his day, and he confirms it was so boring he almost died, and also that Ricky Landis puked in first period, and Tinsley G, there are two Tinsleys in his first period, was so grossed out she threw up too. Then, without taking a breath, he asks what's for dinner, and Ashley hoists the burrito bag into the air. A minute later, he adds, "Aren't you guys a little old for sleepovers?" Ashley looks dismayed. I cackle until she tells Mulder to guess how old I am. Guilelessly, he says, "I don't know, 45? And then she's cackling. "That's older than your mom," I point out. He just shrugs, goes back to playing his game. On Wednesday after work, I shut myself into the guest room to do a video interview with Anika and Clay, the Ocean City Library District Manager and Branch Manager, respectively. "How soon could you be out here?" Anika asks with a sunny smile as we're saying our goodbyes. My heart shoots up into my throat, but my voice stays even. "As soon as I fulfill my 2 weeks' notice." Anika and Clay exchange a smile. I'm rarely the most confident person in the room, but I'm 99% sure I've got it when Clay says, "We'll be in touch as soon as possible." When I leave the guest room, Ashley is waiting for me in the hall with champagne. "I don't want you to go," she says, "but I want you to be happy." By Thursday, I'm actually ahead of schedule for the readathon, but the school calls Ashley at work to come pick up Mulder early because he's finally caught the stomach bug that's been going around. The very last thing I need is to get sick right now, and I debate going back to the apartment for the next 2 days. Instead, I double my hand washing. By midday Friday, Mulder texts Ashley that he hasn't gotten sick at all that day. So far, neither she nor I have any symptoms, so things are looking up. Until I remember I forgot to grab a couple of bags of Target dollar section prizes I'd been stockpiling under my bed. I tell myself that Miles will already be at work when I get there, but the truth is I cut it close. Tempt fate. If the universe wants us to run into each other, we'll run into each other. He's not there, though. He's so thoroughly not there that I wonder if he's been staying elsewhere, a thought I immediately regret because now it's bound to recur when I'm lying in the guest bed tonight. Just because the apartment is spotless, no lamps on, no scent of weed whatsoever, doesn't mean Miles has been sleeping somewhere else. Peter's words echo through me. "They'll get back together. You know that, right?" I refuse to let the thought take hold, partly because I don't believe it, and partly because I have no mental space. It's not dark out yet, but the shades are drawn, everything cast in shadow. I make my way into my room, not bothering with the lights, and dig the Target bags out from under the bed frame. When I stand to go, something draws my eyes to the corner of my dresser, the part of it nearest to the door. A small white box. My heart lurches. I'm fairly sure it's the box of fudge, minus the note, but I open it just to be sure. Chocolate. I'm about to drop it in the trash when I catch sight of Dad's note crumpled there. No part of me is itching to read it, but I'm also thinking about what Mom said, about not wasting time talking ourselves out of hope and avoiding anything that might hurt. I can see now how much time I've spent doing that. I stopped trying to make friends I'd have to move away from. I let Sadie's and my friendship fade away rather than risk confronting her about it and learning, once and for all, that I didn't really matter. When Peter dumped me, my life shrank. Not just because of him, but because of me. I didn't want to go anywhere I might run into him. I didn't want to be reminded of my broken heart. And not to excuse any of his shortcomings, but I hadn't known Dad was married because I hadn't even read my birthday card. I think about Ashley, too, and her ex, how he was fine with things being just okay, too scared to go deeper in search of greatness when it meant risking change. I don't know whether I'll eat the fudge or read my dad's letter, but I stuff both in the bag of dollar spot prizes to take back to Ashley's. Then I leave my room. I turn into the living room, and I collide with something hard enough that red scorches across the backs of my eyelids. Not something, someone, a shadowy figure. I scream, then they scream. There's a brief, clumsy scuffle. Neither of us seems totally sure whether we're attacking or trying to get away. Then a voice yelps, "I'll fucking end you if you don't leave!" Ordinarily, this is the last thing I'd want to hear from someone moving around in the dark in my apartment. In this instance, cool relief rushes from my head to my feet. "Julia," I say.
"Daphne?"
Julia cries. I scuttle sideways and flick the lights on. "You're back?"
"You're back,"
she says. "I didn't go anywhere," I say.
"Tell that to my brother," she says.
Heat hits my cheeks and ears. A hand goes to Julia's hip.
"Wait, I'm mad at you."
"He told you?" I ask.
"That he professed his love to you,"
she says.
"Might have mentioned it. What was more surprising, though, was hearing you didn't tell him you feel the same way, which you do."
"Julia," I say, "it's complicated." She squints, head cocking, the knowing tilt.
"Is it, though?"
An awkward silence unfurls. Finally, she sighs.
"I guess I also need to thank you."
"What? For what?" I say.
"Miles told me you'd been pushing him to be honest with me,"
she says,
"about how he felt about me moving here."
"You guys talked about it?" I say.
"We did,"
she confirms. "How was it?" I ask.
"Horrible,"
she says.
"I was so upset. Crying, mad, the whole thing."
I wince. "I'm sorry."
"And then we kept talking," Julia continues, "and I understood. It's exactly the same thing he did with you."
I'm not following.
"I always thought it was amazing how Miles managed to escape our childhood without becoming suspicious of everyone," she says. "But then he was talking about what happened with you, how he messed up and it convinced him he couldn't be who you need, yada, yada, yada. And I realized all that shit our parents did, it might not have made him mistrust other people, but it sure as hell made him mistrust himself."
My heart tightens and twists.
"He can't see himself clearly," she says. "They made him feel like all he ever does is let people down."
I've seen it over and over again, that self-doubt, the mistrust of his own feelings, the fear of letting any bit of darkness out of himself.
"Here I am, keeping all my problems secret so he won't rush in to fix them," she says. "And he tells me he's scared his childhood broke him. That because of it, he can't be the brother or friend or whatever the people he loves deserve."
I swallow hard. "What did you say?"
"I told him that because of my childhood, I know he can. He always has."
A lump of emotion climbs my esophagus.
"Anyway,"
her gaze falls.
"I'm sure you've got a lot to do."
I swallow. "Welcome back, Julia."
"Thanks," she says. "It's good to be home."
35. Friday, August 16th. One day. I read Dad's note in the middle of the night. "Hey, kiddo. Sorry to take off like this. Got a once-in-a-lifetime offer. Can't wait to tell you all about it on our way back through town. Will you be around in October? Would love to see what an up-north fall looks like. Miss you already. Love, Dad and Starfire." He's the same dad as ever. The one who says one thing, "I love you, I miss you, we'll stick around as long as you'll have us," but does another. But that's not what bothers me about the letter. What bothers me is one word, October, and the low, yearning ache I feel between my ribs when I read it. I start to cry. And then, of course, I call my mom. "Calm down," she says when I start blabbering. "Tell me everything." Finally, I do. It's still dark and damp when I meet Harvey at the front doors on Saturday morning. We're both dressed down in anticipation of the long day ahead. He's wearing a Howard sweatshirt and athletic pants, not the Red Wings ones, while I'm in stretchy knit pants and a baggy cardigan.
"You managed to get any sleep?"
he asks, unlocking the automatic doors. "A little," I say. "You?"
"Not much," he says, "but adrenaline will carry us through. And if not, we can take turns napping in the office."
Inside, the fluorescent lights take their sweet time flickering on. I feel a pang of longing. Nostalgia, I guess, for every library I've ever loved and the little girl who dreamed of this, being the first person in and the last out of a building brimming with books, and feeling like it belonged to me in a way, and I to it. A home when nowhere else felt right. Harvey takes a deep breath.
"Don't you love the way it smells?"
So much, I say.
"That right there," he says, "is why I can't retire. If I could live in this feeling, I would."
"I know," I say. "The kids will be living my childhood dream tonight, staying over in a library." He looks over.
"You did well, Daphne. Really well."
I wonder if I'm glowing. Probably it's too early to glow. Probably I look like the ghost of a milk carton gone sour.
"Let's get to work."
The fantasy team arrives first, ready to transform one corner of the library into a low-budget approximation of a castle with their pre-painted butcher paper backdrops and papier-mâché dragon, its sinuous body segmented into four little arc shapes arranged in a row so that the floor looks like water the creature's swimming through. It is, by nature of being made out of paper by an amateur, utterly and wonderfully horrifying. If this thing came to life, it would do so with gruesome screams at finding itself sentient, yet anatomically improbable. I love it so much. The kids are going to lose it. Even the ones old enough to roll their eyes, like Maya. Once in seventh grade, Mom took me to a midnight launch party for a fantasy series. They passed out wands, which were just sticks they probably found in the brush behind the library. It was silly. It was also magical. I chose a twig with pale green lichen crawling over it, and Mom chose one that was bone white. I felt like I was as close as I'd ever be to true magic. That feeling of curiosity and awe and wonder, that was where I made my home every time we moved, a sensation that couldn't be taken away. Ashley shows up 8 minutes late, breakfast burritos in hand for both me and Harvey. She keeps things running at the desk while he and I coordinate the waves of drop-offs and volunteer check-ins. Around 10:30, the sci-fi and contemporary crews show up, quickly taking over their corners, hanging their tinfoil UFOs from the drop tile and their painted quote and cover posters from R.J. Palacio, Jasmine Warga, Jacqueline Woodson, and Jeff Kinney over in the contemporary area. At 1 p.m., the horror team arrives with faux cobwebs and lightly spooky haunted house paraphernalia. They piece together their set in one of the two community rooms, safely tucked away from the littlest readers. Around 3, the picture book volunteers descend on the story nook. One of them, a local seamstress, has made a giant stuffed, very hungry caterpillar to be won by the top reader of the under-6 crowd, most of whom will go home before dark, while those with older siblings hang on a bit longer. The day's first crisis hits at 3:32, and it's a doozy. I'm out front helping Shirley, the ever-sticky 3-year-old Lila's grandmother, manage drop-offs when Ashley comes bustling outside, sweaty from exertion, giant topknot wobbling. She gives me a look like, "We need to talk," and I excuse myself to follow Ashley a few yards away from the covered walkway at the front of the library. "So," she says, keeping her voice low, "don't freak out." "3 magical words," I say. "Landon caught it," she says. I shake my head. "Caught the stomach bug," she says. "He can't come tonight." "Okay." I nod as my brain spins through its own version of the readathon Google Doc. Landon was going to be in the other community room, the one for refreshments. He was also supposed to go pick up a lot of those refreshments and be our tech guy,
set up the projector and screen, run the videos and live streams. That's not all, Ashley says. My eyes snap back to her face. The corners of her mouth pull wide in an exaggerated grimace. Three other volunteers have called in sick, too. Shit. I should have prepared for this. In a way, I did. I didn't put a cap on volunteers. The more, the better. But our version of more didn't account for losing four people 3.5 hours before start time. I'm trying to come up with a plan, buying myself time with an evenly spaced out, okay, as if some brilliant solution is in the process of being birthed. Back under the walkway, someone calls my name. I'm going to take care of it, Ashley tells me. How? I say. Don't worry about it, she tells me. At my snort, she says, fine, worry about it, but also trust me. I'll figure it out. You go focus on the other 9 million things you need to do. Another volunteer walks out the front doors, scans the lawn, and heads straight for me with a look of abject panic on his face. Go. Ashley shoves me. You put out your fires. I've got this one. Tonight will be amazing. I need it to be, I say. She sets her hands on my shoulders and looks me in the eye. Daphne, remember who this is for. That's why I want to get it right. I get that, she says. But if I've learned anything from parenting, it's that it matters way more that you're present than that you're perfect. Just be here, really be here, and the kids will love it. My shoulders loosen. I can do that. Of course you can, she says. You're Daphne fucking Vincent. Aw, I touch my chest. You know my last name and my middle name. 20 minutes until go time, from the comfort of a paper-lined toilet seat, I check my phone. Dad has called 3 times in an hour. My stomach plummets. I don't want to call him back, especially right now, but I'm more anxious about what might happen if I don't. I flush the toilet, wash my hands, leave the bathroom, and step outside to make the call. The early evening sky has a summery glow, the heat dense except when the breeze billows off the water. I sweep my hair off my neck into a bun and hit the call button. Hey, kid, Dad says. I bypass my own hello. Is everything okay?
What do you mean?
He says. Is there some kind of emergency? Then, to his non-response, I say, you called me 3 times. Were they pocket dials?
No, he says. I just wanted to wish you luck. Or break a leg, or whatever is apropos for this situation.
What situation? I ask.
Your big thing tonight, he says. The library thing.
I can't think of a single thing to say.
Sorry we had to hightail it out of there, by the way, he says.
It's fine, I say. I didn't expect anything else. Dad laughs.
That's what I tried to tell him. I said, I know my kid, and she doesn't get hung up on that kind of thing. He seems to think you're some kind of high-strung neurotic type. I mean, he must, or he wouldn't have...
Wait, I say. What are you talking about?
Your boyfriend, he says.
Peter?
The new guy, he says. Miles.
I massage my brow. Dad, I already told you Miles is just a friend.
Well, that's what I thought.
He says brightly, like I've just proved a point for him, or maybe won him a bet.
But the way he was talking...
Dad, I still don't know what you're talking about. A moment of silence.
He didn't tell you?
I have neither time nor energy to play 20 questions. Tell me what?
That he was driving up to see us,
he says. Driving up to see you? I repeat.
2 weeks ago,
he says.
After we left. I've been trying to get a hold of you since then.
I'm so lost. I guess I am going to play 20 questions. Came up where?
The island, he says. Mackinac. Guess he left me a voicemail first, but who checks those?
Me, I think.
Mom.
Probably a huge percentage of the world.
Anyway, he came up and chewed me out about us having to leave early.
Dad says, with a distinct air of, "Can you believe that?" It's a creative use of the phrase, having to leave, as if he were driven out of town at gunpoint or took an emergency flight home to be with a dying pet.
"Kid tried to guilt us into driving all the way back down to you before we headed out to meet Starfire's family. Really upset her with the things he was saying about me, Daff. She didn't talk to me for like half the next day. Caused all sorts of problems."
When did you say this happened? I say, still reeling.
"Well, he showed up the Monday before last," he says, "and missed the final ferry back, so we had to ask Christopher if he could stay the night. Pretty uncomfortable situation he put us in."
Christopher? At this point, I really just need a buzzer to hit every time he says something that elicits a series of question marks from me.
"Our buddy," Dad says. "The one we met at the dunes who's got this great house up there and a hotel. House is putting it lightly, though. I don't know if this guy is really an investor like he said or if that was code for Mob Don, but..."
He whistles his amazement. "Well, if your dad's going to ditch you for someone he just met, and there's no hostage situation involved, he could at least have the decency to stay in a mansion paid for with cocaine and shakedowns." "Dad, I have to go," I say. "My event's starting any minute."
"Right, right, I won't keep you," he says. "Just wanted to tell you congrats, and I love you. You already know that, though."
If I had that buzzer, I might hit it now. If I had more time, I might ask, Do you really? Instead, I push out a breathless, "Yeah," and end the call. Monday night. That's where Miles was. Monday night and Tuesday morning. That's where Miles went. Unshakably cool, invariably well-liked, chronically fine Miles drove 2 hours to confront my father. Suddenly, the semi-pathetic box of fudge makes sense. It was a consolation prize, just not in the way I thought. He'd tried. I told him how I felt, how I wanted my dad to come back, and he'd tried to bring him. And maybe I should be mad he overstepped, but I don't feel mad. I feel raw. I feel like the boundary between me and the world is stretching thinner, making me tender and vulnerable, a water balloon fit to burst. Why wouldn't he have just told me? But I know the answer. I know Miles, and he knows me. I look toward the road, the sparkling band of blue water, the scraggly beech trees blurring behind a wall of tears. He knows me. He loves me. It wasn't just a pretty word thrown out in a convenient moment. It was true. And it makes me feel brave being loved by him. It makes me safe enough to do the thing I never could. I wipe the tears away and redial Dad.
"You forget something?" he asks.
"I only have a minute," I say.
"Me too," he goes on. "Star and I are going golfing. Met someone who owns a course."
"I'm not trying to hurt you," I start. "I just haven't said this before, and I don't think I will if I wait too long trying to figure out a better way of saying it." I think Dad feels the seismic shift. He doesn't rush in with a joke. My last breath feels like the one you'd take before smashing a sledgehammer into a wall. I'd tempered my expectations, packed them tight into bricks, built a fortress to protect me. But keeping every glimmer of hope out has isolated me too. And I want to be seen. I want to be loved. I want to live with the hope that things can get better, even if in the end they don't. "You were a shitty dad," I tell him. "You were never there. I spent so much time just waiting for you. And when you did show up, it was never when you said. You never stuck around as long as you promised, and because of you, the whole world, my whole world, felt totally fucking unpredictable. And maybe you really do love me, but I don't know that. How would I? I've never been your priority. I'm a pit stop. And that guy you think doesn't know me?" I choke up here, need a second to force the emotion down. "He didn't even tell me he tried to get you to come back for me. Because he knew it would kill me, and he wasn't going to let you break what's left of my heart. So now I get it.
Why Mom used to make excuses for you. She wasn't protecting you, she was protecting me. But I'm grown now. She can't always guard me from you. It's my job to protect myself, not hide, not just try to stop feeling this constant ache. I can't keep doing this. I don't want to be a person who expects the worst. Something has to change. So the next time you come to town, ask me first. And if you want to leave, don't be a coward. Don't make the people who love me make your excuses. You can tell me to my face, or we can be done with this. Pin drop silence. Then, finally, he murmurs,
"Oh, Daphne."
The doors whisk open behind me, and Ashley pops her head out. "You ready?"
"You have to understand.
I've got to go," I tell him. "I'll call you when it's a good time for me." I hang up and square my shoulders. "Ready," I say. 36. I step up in front of the reference desk. I've never heard the library like this, so raucous, humming with energy. And this is just our volunteers. Ashley cups her hands around her mouth.
"Listen up, people. This is our children's librarian, Daphne, and she's going to walk us through protocol before the kids get here."
The room quiets. I can only see the first several rows of volunteers, Huma and her husband among them. I steady my office chair and climb onto it.
"First of all, thank you all for being here."
Rowdy applause erupts from the back of the room, along with a high-pitched whoop. I recognize Julia's voice before I spot her, standing just beyond the story nook with a handful of other last-minute volunteers. Elda, the cheesemonger Miles introduced me to at the prom, once again dressed like an 80s fairy godmother. Barb and Lenore in matching tracksuits, tiny Barb's pink, tall Lenore's lavender. Katya, with the baby bangs from Cherry Hill, and a person with a shaved head and septum ring who I recognize but haven't met. And just behind them, a head of messy dark hair, soft brown eyes. My heart seems to unzip. Miles smiles tentatively, an apology of a smile. Should I be here right now? "You should always be here," my heart answers. My nervous system agrees, a feeling like some stovetop warmed caramel drizzled over me. I wish I could take back everything I said to him. I spent so much time accustoming myself to one kind of surprise, the kind hinging on disappointments, hurts, small abandonments, and emotional bartering, that I'd stopped considering there might be any other. A surprise, it turns out, is different when it comes from someone who knows and loves you. Beside me, Ashley coughs. I have no idea how long I've been staring at him, feeling like I might burst into confetti or tears. "It means so much to me," I say, voice already hoarse. I tear my gaze from him and sweep it over the audience. "To be a part of a community like this. To me, libraries have always represented the best of humanity. The way we all share knowledge and space and how we find ways to look after each other. It's not a perfect system, but it's powerful. I know there are a lot of other places you could be on a Saturday night." My throat constricts. "There aren't words for how special this is. That you've shown up for the kids and Waning Bay and me." I let myself look at Miles just for an instant. "It matters. So much." His lips part, his brow smoothing out. For a moment, it's just the two of us. I clear my throat and pivot.
"So, everyone signed up to work in registration? You'll be over here with Ashley."
This is how time works. The things you wait months for blink past, like the flash of a strobe, huge swaths lost in the dark beats between. Elda runs our refreshments room, which, thanks to her last-minute donations, has moved from sleepover fare to a bizarre mix of cupcakes, potato chips, Mountain Dew, and top-tier charcuterie. The parents are thrilled. The cheesemonger is thrilled. But no one's more thrilled than Harvey. At first, I think it's a purely cheese-based joy Elda's inspired in him. But even as her supplies dwindle, he keeps doubling back to the community room. I watch them laughing together through the windows and think again that sometimes the unexpected is better than what you plan. The same universe that dispassionately takes things away can bring you things you weren't imaginative enough to dream up. Every hour on the hour, the kids line up for prizes, then skip and run and tumble back to their reading spots of choice, or else to the Nook to watch a virtual author visit. In Landon's absence, Katya's friend Banks, the person with the shaved head and septum ring, who, it turns out, works part-time at Fika, runs tech. Miles is ostensibly on trash and cleanup duty, though at one point I catch him in the sci-fi area, the Fontana triplets dangling off him like he's the rotating pillar at the center of a high-flying swing-set carousel. Julia and another volunteer run the picture book circle for the not-yet readers, and Huma helps kids in the contemporary section choose their next reads. Then there's Maya. Tucked back in the fantasy corner, on side-by-side beanbags with Ethan from the YA Backlist Book Club. They aren't speaking, just silently reading the same Alice Hoffman book, The Rules of Magic, while, over by the study tables, Maya's mom chats with Ethan's dads. Maya's and my two-person book club might be coming to an end soon, I realize, and I'm tempted to feel a bit sad, but I'm also so proud of her for stepping outside of her comfort zone. And I'm proud of myself, too. Feel like I've honored the 12-year-old girl I was. Like in a very small way, maybe I've made this already wonderful place just a tiny bit better. It's made me better. The hum and din settle to the quiet contentment I most associate with the library, and most of the younger kids and their guardians siphon off by midnight. The soda and chocolate cherries keep the preteens going strong until 3. At that point, I duck back into the office to power nap under the desk, but the adrenaline won't let me sleep. Occasional shrieks and giggles make their way to me, and I catch myself grinning at the underside of the desk. I pull my phone out and open my messages with my mom. She sent one this morning, yesterday morning now, technically, that I haven't replied to yet. "Woke up thinking about you," she writes. "Proud of you, my brave girl." I feel even more sure about my decision than I did last night. I love this library. I love my coworkers and I love the patrons. I love the lake and the farm stands and barn and Ashley and Julia and Miles. I love Miles. And I also love my mother. A part of me will always be just a little bit homesick for her when we're apart. She's my constant, and I don't take that lightly. "I love you," I tell her. "Love you more," she says. After tonight, I'll tell the others. For now, I don't want to think about the future. I want to be wholly present. I dust myself off and leave the office. Take in the soft musk of books and the hint of pine and something I can't name but recognize like an old friend. I feel a bittersweetness that this moment can't last, that time will pull us along soon. But for the first time in a while, I'm excited about the unknown. I'm looking forward to the surprises. It's still dark at 6:40, the crowd having majorly thinned. Mulder is fast asleep atop a table, next to a friend who's reading a manga with a flashlight, eyelids sagging every several seconds. We've stayed busy enough that Miles and I haven't had a chance to exchange more than a cursory, "How are you?" and "Good, how are you?" and "Thank you for being here." I've been putting out small fires and, in one tragic situation, unclogging toilets for long enough to become famished. When I pop my head into the refreshment room, it looks like a powerful clan of Vikings with nut allergies has rolled through. Elda the cheesemonger and Harvey don't even seem to notice me, just keep chatting in the far corner of the room, their uncomfortable wooden seats angled together. I grab a brownie and cram it into my mouth as I leave the community room. "Keep it PG, Vincent," Ashley teases. "Some of the kids are still awake." At my baffled look, she says, "You were doing your good food moan." "Sorry," I say, mouth full. She and the rest of the cleanup crew have started gathering the final wave of flotsam and jetsam from the night. Over by the front doors, Miles is sorting the recycling, trash, and compost into bags. "They're divine, aren't they?" she says, jutting her chin toward the brownie. "Really, really good," Ashley smiles. "Miles brought them. Did you know he bakes?" I sneak another glance at him. He's turned away, stretching his arms over his head sleepily, a band of skin visible along his waist until his arms fall back to his sides. Ashley cackles.
"Now, that sound was definitely not PG."
I face her, cheeks burning. "I didn't make a sound." From her smirk, I realize she's joking with me. She bumps her elbow against mine and jerks her chin toward Miles. "Go on." "It's not over yet," I say. She rolls her eyes. "Daphne, look around. You're welcome to stick around for 10 more minutes if you're dying to, but when the timer's up, I'm going to sweep you off the stage like an amateur night executioner while the three remaining kids here boo and hurl chocolate cherries at your head."
I'm still hesitant. Shouldn't I see this through to the end?
She drops her trash bag at my feet and grabs my hands in hers. "You did. You made it through the summer. We pulled off the event of the year. The hard part's over." A huge weight lifts from my chest. The knot beneath it loosens and unwinds. We did it. I made it through. We both laugh, slap happy from lack of sleep. She pulls me into a hug and I squeeze her back, the trash bag now sitting at our feet like a puppy. "Not sure what the rules are about saying this at work," I say, "but I love you."
"I fucking love you too," she says. "Now go get your man."
37. Sunday, August 18th. Finally. "Hi," I say when I'm finally right in front of him, that last yard of silent eye contact having taken somewhere between 11 seconds and 14 years. He rubs the side of his head.
"Hi."
Neither of us rushes to fill the pause. My heart feels like a flame, burning higher, higher, higher. I clear my throat.
"Are you up for a walk?"
He seems surprised.
"Are you?
Unless you just want to go collapse into bed, yeah." Ears suddenly fiery hot, I add, "If you need to sleep, I mean."
"I drank so much Red Bull, I could sprint right now," he says. "But I also might have a heart attack."
"You're in luck," I tell him. "The library paid for me to get CPR certified." He smiles.
"Then what are we waiting for?"
"Nothing, I guess."
The air is misty, the streets and sidewalks empty apart from the occasional spandex-clad jogger or bicyclist. Out on the water, a couple of boats drift, but still, it feels like just the two of us in a world that's fast asleep. We wander along the lake's edge, and the silence doesn't feel awkward. It's its own kind of conversation, a reintroduction after our time apart.
"Thank you for being there last night," I finally say.
"I was always going to be," he says. "Just so you know, no matter what, I would have been there."
I blink back the rising tears.
"I know. Elda, Katya, and Banks, on the other hand," he says, "getting them to help took bartering."
"Well, Elda, at least, will probably let you off the hook," I say. "She and my boss were really hitting it off."
"They were cute,"
Miles agrees. Another few minutes pass. We turn up a side street. My heart is vibrating. I take a deep breath. Slowly release it. "I know you went to see my dad." Miles' gaze slices toward me. He stops.
"I'm sorry. I should have asked you before I did that. It was stupid."
"I understand why you didn't," I say. "Really." The grooves at the inside corners of his brows soften.
"The other night, I think you misunderstood me. I didn't wake up and panic. I woke up happy. Happier than I can remember being."
He rubs the back of his head.
And then Petra called, and she was sobbing. So hard I couldn't understand her. I'd never seen her cry before. I honestly thought someone had died. She asked if I could come see her, and I said yes, because I was worried. I still care about her.
I know you do, I say thickly.
I got to Peter's place, and she was sitting out front.
He lets out an exasperated breath. His eyes cut up to me, watching for a reaction.
She told me they broke up.
I don't say anything.
You don't seem surprised,
he says.
I'm not, I say.
Peter told me. Something flashes across his face, too quick for me to read.
Right,
he says softly. He rubs the back of his head, nodding a few more times. He clears his throat, but it stays hoarse.
So you've talked.
He came by, I say.
His gaze sweeps to our feet, and he nods again.
Miles?
His dark eyes lift to mine, faintly glossed.
Shit, what's wrong?
I can't help it. I reach for him, slide my hands up to his shoulders.
Nothing.
He forces a smile.
I'm happy for you.
Happy for me? I say.
He flushes.
I mean, if you guys are...
If we're what?
His teeth scrape over his bottom lip.
Oh my God. Understanding clatters through me. Miles, no. You don't think that Peter and I are... Absolutely not.
I actually laugh, and then a horrible thought causes me a full body twitch.
Wait, you and Petra aren't...
No,
he says, shaking his head.
When I got over there, she was trying to tell me how the whole thing was a mistake, so I told her about you.
That we slept together? I say, bewildered.
He gives a surprised laugh.
Oh, Daphne, that I love you.
Hearing it again feels like swallowing a lit light bulb.
Oh.
I didn't mean to tell her first.
The tops of his cheeks redden.
That I'm in love with you.
My eyes sting. My limbs go shivery, and a heaviness presses in on my chest. He loves me. Present tense. And I love him. He knows me, and I see him.
And when I told Petra,
he swallows.
I guess she kind of got into my head. I mean, I was already in my head, but she said things that fucked with me.
What do you mean? I say.
His expression verges on pained.
You can tell me, I promise.
It's just,
he says.
Peter told her about your dad, and Petra started saying this stuff about how you'd been through too much, that you weren't the kind of person who could deal with uncertainty. She and I are, but not you and Peter.
And what, she's the expert on what I can and can't deal with? I ask.
He smiles faintly. His hands circle my wrists, his thumbs running up and down my veins as his face softens.
They broke up because Petra decided she didn't want kids, and Peter did.
Oh, I say.
His gaze drops, his touch stilling.
And she reminded me that's something that matters to you, too. And I already knew that. It wasn't a surprise, but...
He chews on his bottom lip, his gaze so warm and fluid I feel like I could swan dive into it, like it would rush up to meet me on every side.
She pointed out that I'm not exactly equipped for that,
he murmurs.
And all I could think about was her family and what they thought of me. They were nice, but they never thought I was good enough. And then there's my family shit and everything your dad's put you through, and I just thought...
His Adam's apple bobs.
Suddenly it seemed selfish of me to love you.
At the tenderness in his face and touch, the need in his expression, my heart cracks.
To try to be with you when I know what you want,
he says under his breath.
I can't give you a family like the Collinses or the Comers. I feel like there's so much space between who I am and who I want to be, and there's no one to show me how to get there. And it doesn't really make sense, but I thought maybe if I could get through to your dad, if I could help fix that, then it would prove I'm capable of giving you everything you want.
Miles, I begin,
That's why I freaked out, he continues. And as soon as I saw you again, I felt so stupid because I'd spent the last 2 days acting like you were Petra. Because deep down, she always thought she was settling, and so I did too. I always felt like I was making up for something or trying to win her. And I thought that made me lucky to be with someone who chose me, even though no one in her life got it. His voice thickens. I didn't learn what love was supposed to feel like. It doesn't feel natural or come easily to me to let anyone close. But you make love so easy, Daphne. You make me think I already deserve it exactly how I am. And I feel lucky every time you look at me, not because I think I've managed to earn you, but because it feels like you don't need me to. Like you just like me. He shakes his head, voice fraying as he corrects himself. Like you love me. That's how I feel with you. And I know I'm not who you pictured yourself with, but I think I could be, eventually, if you'll let me. So don't go. Because I don't want you to. Because you're my best friend, and I'm in love with you. Miles, I say again. I know we're really different, he says. But I love all the things about you that aren't like me. I love that you feel your feelings. I love that you know what you want. I love that you're always where you say you'll be when you say you'll be there. Miles. His brows pinch together, a mix of hope and fear on his face that I feel deep in my own gut. Can I show you something? His features flatten. After a second, he nods. I take his hand, his pulse thundering into my palm as I lead him down the sidewalk. We turn right at the cross street and stop at the house on the corner, facing the broken gate and crooked for sale sign. His eyes dart to the front door, then back to me. You're right, I say. He blinks. When I moved here, I say, I had a picture in my head. I knew exactly what my house was going to look like and who I'd spend the holidays with, and I knew who we'd go out with on the weekends, and I had an idea of how many kids I'd have and even what their names would be. I could basically picture every single day of the rest of my life. I'm not spontaneous, I say. Surprises make me nervous, and I've moved around too much to want to, like, live in a van or backpack for months. I don't need that, Miles rasps. I don't think I even want that anymore, if I ever did. That's my point, I say. He shakes his head once, brow knitted tight. I knew exactly what to expect for the rest of my life, I explain. And it was comforting to me. But then it blew up, and all I could think about was running, getting away from the mess. Then one day, after we started getting close, I was walking to work. And I saw this house. My voice goes husky. It was the first time in a year that I wanted something new. When you told me how you felt, I swallow that same glowing light bulb down, that you loved me. That's why I panicked. He looks toward the rundown bungalow. Because I don't fit. My throat burns, like there's too much pressure building in my chest, steam that needs to be let out. Because I could see it, I say. Right away. I could see a whole new life, all these new things to want, and that's fucking terrifying, Miles. His hands fly up to cradle my jaw. I won't hurt you, Daphne. You don't know that, I whisper. I know how hard I'll try, he says. Just stay. I love you. I want you. Stay. My hands climb up to the back of his neck, another uncontrollable bearing of my heart. He swallows hard. Come home. Please. I can't. I shake my head. Before he can argue, I go on. No matter what you said today, I'd already made up my mind. He draws back, a shadow passing over his face. I wasn't intentionally obfuscating the point, but seeing his shattered look, I realize I phrased this the worst way possible. No, I say.
I mean, regardless of what happens between us, I'm not done here.
His head just barely cocks, a wave of love pummeling me at the familiar gesture.
I'm getting my own place, I explain.
After a flicker of confusion, he looks sidelong toward the for sale sign.
Not that. I can't afford that. I found a one-bedroom, close to Fika.
I really don't understand, Daphne.
You mean so much to me, Miles, I say. So much. But you can't be everything. You were right that I'd love it here. I do. And you're a huge part of why I want to build a life here. But I can't build it around you. If this ends, I need to know that I don't just disappear. I need to have my own stuff that's not about anyone else. Whether it works out between us or not, I need that.
I want it to work, he insists. It can.
I think so too, I promise. I can't imagine ever meeting anyone more wonderful than you, so if it doesn't work, I'm going to stay single, go to a sperm bank, and get into CrossFit.
A goofy smile overtakes his face.
You really think so?
Not the CrossFit part. I'm incredibly lazy, I say. But the rest of it. You're wonderful. You're the reason for the word wonderful. It really shouldn't be used for anything else. You make me want to see the best in everyone. You're the person I want to be with when everything's going wrong instead of just wanting to skip over those times entirely. I love that you're so present that you always forget to keep track of your phone, and I love that when you're late, you never make excuses, but you always have a good reason. You're the most generous person I've ever met, even to people who've given you no reason to be generous, and you always come through for the people you care about. I honestly can't totally figure out why someone as good as you would love me when I can be kind of a pessimistic asshole. But I do feel like the luckiest person in the world to be who you want. Because I want you too. I love you too. I love you in a way that feels brand new. You make every single thing that went wrong feel like it was just a step in the right direction. And it makes me excited for life to keep surprising me. You aren't what I pictured, I say. You are so, so, so much better than what my cynical little brain could have ever come up with.
My voice wavers and cracks at the end, and even if I knew what to say next, I don't think I'd be able to get it out. Miles studies me, his eyes soft now as I try to pull myself together. He tugs my hands up to his chest, holding them over his heart.
That's it? He asks quietly. That's the speech.
It was longer than that, but I've slept like 4 hours in the last 3 days, so that's what's left in my brain,
I say scratchily.
You're so nice and so hot and so fun and funny, and you smell really good, and the brownies you made for last night were amazing.
And you love me,
he says softly.
So much, I agree. I feel like, why would anyone who can't date you even bother dating? And somehow, you like me.
Love, he corrects. Somehow you love me.
I do,
I tell him. I do. I am. Right now. Every muscle in my body is busy loving him, on the sidewalk in front of my new dream house, the first rays of a new morning filtering across the street. One of his hands pulls free from the tangle of our fingers and slides into my hair.
Can we go home now?
He asks. Actually, I say. My apartment isn't ready until next week.
In that case, he says, do you want to come back to my place?
Can we lock Julia out for a while?
He laughs.
We'll send her to Ashley's for a bit.
Then yes. He crushes me to him, a deep kiss full of feeling, joy and fear and need and hope. A rough, no-holds-barred kiss that prompts one car rolling past to honk its horn, the automobile equivalent of a wolf whistle, or maybe a scolding. We pull back, smiling, our foreheads resting together. We smile and breathe and touch one another and dream about the future without saying any of it aloud. Summer turning into fall. Trips with Ashley and Mulder to the apple orchards an hour south.
bonfires with Julia as the air chills and the leaves blaze into color, poker nights with cigar smoke thick in the air, and long morning walks with hot chai from Fika in hand. And even the hellish cold of winter, a new apartment complete with gas fireplace, bundled hikes through feet of snow, Miles and I slipping out of our clothes and under the sheets to warm each other. And things I can't dream up to. The ways it will all go wrong, and the beauty that can only happen in the wake. A second act I fell into, and the home that I chose as much as it chose me. I can't wait. I can't wait for this whole world I've invited to surprise me. 38. Friday, October 3rd. 412 days since I stayed. Through the door, Celine Dion is bemoaning the fact that she doesn't want to be all by herself. The chime of the oven timer barely cuts through the song, and I flip on the interior light to check that the edges of the brownies have gone crispy, the top cracking in that mouth-watering way. I pull them out and set them atop the stove, eyeing the clock. Of course, today I would be running behind. I jog to the shut-tight door and rap on it. He doesn't hear the first time, so I knock again. The music stops.
Yeah?
Miles calls.
You okay?
I ask. A pause.
Yeah?
That didn't inspire confidence.
Can I come in?
The door swings open. He's standing there shirtless, shaving cream covering the lower half of his face, razor in hand.
I thought I should shave,
he says, by way of explanation.
Since your mom's coming.
I fight a smile. You once told me that women of a certain age love the scruffy thing.
Oh, they do.
He leans against the sink.
I can't have your mom falling in love with me.
A ridiculous chortle jars out of me. I'd actually finally talked her into going on one date with a guy from her gym. It had gone surprisingly well, but afterward, she'd told me, I think I'm too busy to date. The more important thing, though, was that she was too happy with the life she'd built for herself to change it for anyone who didn't set her world on fire. And I liked that for her. She deserved the life she'd worked so hard for. You know I think you're unbelievably hot, I tell Miles. But I think Holly Vincent is safe from your charms. His smile deepens.
I want to impress her.
She already knows you, Miles, I say. We'd gone to her place for Christmas last year, slept on the tiny pull-out couch, and eaten Korean barbecue takeout while watching It Happened on Fifth Avenue, followed immediately by Die Hard.
Yeah, but this will be the first time she sees us here.
He waves toward our new, old place. Technically, it will be the first time anyone's seen us here, other than Ashley and Julia. The place is still a wreck, but the living room, one bathroom, and Miles's and my bedroom at least are functional at this point. Even if one of the diamond-paned windows is literally being held together by packing tape, and the power goes out when we run more than one fan. It will take years to fix up this eye-bleedingly orange cottage, 2.5 blocks from the green one with the same floor plan. But I don't mind. I love it enough as it is that I'm happy to wait. The doorbell rings, which is a surprise. It only works about every 8th time someone touches it.
Shit, Miles says. I'm late, sorry.
He grabs the towel off the rack to wipe off his shaving cream, thoughts of a smooth jaw abandoned. It's okay, I say. Just put on a shirt and meet me in the living room. Or skip the shirt. I told everyone tonight's casual. He doesn't even wait to finish laughing before kissing me, leaving foam behind on my face when we pull apart. He wipes my chin off with the towel.
Be right there, he promises.
I'm not worried about my mom or tonight. I'm more nervous for next week. Sadie's first visit to see me since we started really talking again. For months after I decided to stay in Waning Bay, I waited for that splinter in my heart to push its way out, to stop missing her. The night Miles and I decided to buy a house together, we went to dinner to celebrate, then walked home past a bookshop. Sadie's favorite writer, the one whose event Miles had taken me to all those months ago, had a new release sitting in the window. On a whim, I popped in and bought it. But I couldn't bring myself to read it, so it sat on a shelf for weeks before finally I picked it up, devoured it in one sitting, and closed it with tears streaming down my cheeks. The very first thing I did when I finished that book was reach to text her. An impulse, an instinct. And even though I didn't send the message, the feeling didn't go away either. For another week, I moved through the world feeling like I'd forgotten something, like there was somewhere I should be, like there was someone I'd meant to call. I was hurt and angry and confused by the distance in our relationship, but more than that, I missed my friend. I didn't want to write her off. So I wrote her a letter. A letter seemed more Sadie than an email. Austenian, even. In college, she'd had personalized stationery and a wax seal stamp, but I had to settle for a pure Michigan sticker. The day she got the letter, right after she read it, she'd called me right away, and even though I was terrified, I answered on the second ring. We'd talked for hours. We'd both cried. She'd been engaged for 2 months by then.
"I wanted to tell you so badly," she said, "but I didn't think you wanted to hear from me. I thought, when you and Peter broke up, I thought you were pushing me away because of Cooper, because as long as I'm with him, I'm kind of stuck with Peter, you know?"
And I did know. Peter and Cooper were like family, the real kind who will always love you even when your decisions make no sense to them. The decision, for her, had never been me or Peter. It was her best friend or the love of her life. And now that I understood, I realized I didn't need it to feel like an easy choice after all. Things were allowed to be complicated. They were allowed to be messy. We were allowed to disagree and argue and even hurt each other on occasion, and it didn't mean it was time to let the revolving door of life carry us away from each other. Sometimes things are hard. They just are. That first phone call had been like a waterfall. But after that, our texts and calls had been slow and steady. We still aren't back to where we used to be. Maybe we never will be. But we are something. We still love each other. We're still trying. As for how she'll mesh with my new life and friends here, I have no idea. But I'm working on being excited instead of nervous about the unknown. So many of the most beautiful things in life are unexpected. Look at Dad and Starfire. It's not like he's suddenly a different person, but he's more settled, less restless. He's actually made it to 2 of our last 3 scheduled visits. And to be fair, he and Starfire won an all-expenses-paid trip to Switzerland, on a hot tip from their psychic, that overlapped with that 3rd visit, so I can't really blame him for that one. At the front door, I smooth down my skirt and swing it open. Door, not skirt.
"Hi!"
both women on the front step shriek. Ashley's sun-bronzed from her solo eat-pray-love-style trip to Portugal, most of which she spent with a gorgeous local named Afonso, who already has plane tickets to visit her next month.
"Happy housewarming!"
she cries, shoving an enormous bottle of Espumante toward me.
"That's from both of us," Julia says.
Ashley scoffs.
"I bought the bow," Julia says. "I'm a 24-year-old barista. Give me a break."
"I thought you were bringing a date," I say to Jules.
"That guy you just went to Chicago with?"
"Ryan,"
she rolls her eyes.
"He cut his fingernails on the bus ride."
"Ew,"
Ashley and I say in unison. Julia nods solemnly.
"Flags so red, they veered toward maroon."
"Come in, come in."
Instead, they pin me in a tight hug between the two of them. The heat is sticky against our skin, the buzz of insects in our overgrown front yard loud enough to dull the resumed singing of one Ms. Celine Dion.
"Okay," Julia says, pulling back. "I'm taking control of the playlist."
I've never known a happier man who loves sad songs more, Ashley muses. Inside, Julia talks Miles into letting her take over the sound bar. He finishes making a batch of margaritas and adds salt and pepper to the guacamole. Barb and Lenore let themselves in a few minutes later.
Barb's arms loaded with bags of freshly picked apples, and Lenore's with a housewarming bouquet of lavender. Mom's cab from the airport shows up next. After giving me and Miles each a rib-cracking hug, she introduces herself to everyone without any hesitation. We'd invited her to stay with us, said we'd camp in the living room so she could take the bed, but she'd insisted on booking an Airbnb with a home gym. Harvey and Elda are the last to arrive. They knock rather than ring, or else the bell just doesn't work this time. They make quite a pair. Harvey in his Red Wing sweatsuit, a box of cigars under his arm, Elsa with her pink disco ball earrings and elegant cheese board, wrapped in beeswax cloth. Everyone's here now. The family I didn't expect, minus Mulder, who is strictly banned from poker night due to strong language, smoking, gambling. Take your pick, really. He's not allowed to join until he's 18, the same rule Ashley's parents had for her. I take Harvey and Elda back to the living room, and there's one last round of introductions for Mom. She doesn't drink often, so her few sips of margarita must be hitting her. She tears up when she shakes Harvey's hand and thanks him for taking such good care of my girl.
She's a great employee, he says, and a wonderful friend. Terrible poker player, though.
Mom cackles. She's always been too honest for her own good. Except that one time you told that girl you grew up on a horse farm. Remember that, Daphne? I'd finally sort of forgotten, I say.
And the time you told your ex-fiancé you were dating his new fiancé's ex-boyfriend, Julia puts in.
What's this now? Elda sets the cheese board on the counter. Harvey didn't tell you, Ashley says.
I don't gossip about the staff, he says, with false and unconvincing sternness that doesn't hide his grin.
Miles slips his arms around my waist, the wood smoke and ginger smell folding around me, my heart pattering at the feeling of him kissing the side of my neck. I let myself lean back into him, the best feeling in the world. At least the best feeling that's appropriate to have in front of your mother. You really don't know this already? I ask Elda. She shakes her head.
It's how Daphne and I got together.
Miles's arms tighten around me. Elda claps her hands together.
Oh, I love a good meet cute. Let's hear it.
I crane my neck over my shoulder to look at him. His dimples sink into his beard, and it feels like my heart is unzipping. Stepping out of its calloused skin, a glowing, sunlit thing.
Funny story, he says,
but he doesn't go on, just watches me and waits. He knows how much I love to tell it. This is Julia Whalen. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Funny Story by Emily Henry. This program was produced by Kelly Gilday, edited by John Marshall Media. Text copyright 2024 by Emily Henry Books, LLC. Production copyright 2024 Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.